incorporating routine genomic screening into practice.
Use of a novel anti-inflammatory agent to treat poor heart function.
Can continuous glucose monitoring teach us something about diabetes subtypes?
And does the type of weapon used in an assault affect the likelihood of death?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on August 3rd, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'm going to start with the one that's not actually a study. It's actually kind of an opinion and a summation of what's currently taking place in genomic screening in healthcare. That's in Annals of Internal Medicine. I thought this one was informative in that I had no idea, for example, that Geisinger Health System had announced in May of this year that they were going to employ DNA sequencing as part of their routine clinical care to their rather significant number of patients. They also published a paper in the journal Science in October 2017 where they talked about, hey, this is what we're doing in our research. And they guesstimate, and I'm going to call it a guesstimate, that 3.5% of volunteers in this project, which was 100,000 research volunteers who consented, would receive clinical results from a list of 76 actionable genes. So they wanted to say, hey, can we use this to identify subclinical disease and then intervene in these folks? So in this opinion paper, they take a look at how can we do this? What's the best way for us to do it? And one of the things that they advocate, and I advocate also, is that there's got to be some kind of integration between what consumers take a look at. As we know, there's plenty of genomic marketing to consumers. I specifically cite a study we talked about with the 21-gene assay as a predictive model for breast cancer care. So how do we integrate what consumers are actually able to access? How do we integrate research results, which are increasingly important? And of course, I hear about those all the time at Johns Hopkins. And then the ones that might be done by health systems such as Geisinger. But they also say that, gosh, 1% of the U.S. population does have an identifiable genetic risk for something that is actionable. So it's a laudatory goal.
I think that this opinion article raises more questions than provides satisfying answers. The fact that someone has a genetic risk doesn't mean, first of all, that they're going to get the disease. And these actionable genes aren't really tied to any healthcare system that informs either the patient or the physician of what to do. It's far from being used in routine clinical care at this particular time.
We did talk about the 21-gene assay with regard to breast cancer. It is used in clinical care, and I guess I would respectfully submit that unless attempts are made to really integrate all these different places from which we're getting genetic information and to see whether someone who has a purported genetic risk can be successfully managed in a way that helps them avoid that outcome, we're never going to know.
So Elizabeth, there's two different issues. One is, can we use genetic information to identify the proper treatment of an identified disease? And that's what the genetic analysis does for breast cancer treatment. This is an entirely different issue, and that is, you take a group of individuals that don't have any disease, and you look at their genetics, you identify, are they at risk? I think it's interesting, but I think it generates a lot more questions than it provides answers at this particular time. I'm not saying that it won't provide some information in the future. It's just too preliminary at this particular time.
I'm still interested in these outcomes from Geisinger. Let's go from here to an issue of major public health implications, and that's in JAMA Open. It's taking a look at calibers of handguns and mortality.
In 2016, there were over 38,000 deaths and over 116,000 non-fatal injuries due to firearms. We've heard people say, well, guns don't kill people, people kill people. It's the intent that drives the lethality and not the particular firearm. So what these authors attempted to do was they looked at a cross-sectional study using 5 years of extracted data from investigation files kept by the Boston Police Department to determine if the fatality rate actually did depend upon the type of firearm used. They identified 511 gunshot victims, half of whom died. And what they determined was, in effect, the caliber, or that is the size of the bullet, did in fact affect the lethality For example, if you use a medium caliber bullet compared to a small caliber bullet, it doubled the risk of there being a lethal outcome. If it was a large caliber bullet, it increased the risk of death by 4 to 5 fold. Why is this important? You say, well, gosh, it makes sense that a bigger bullet's more likely to cause death. This is one of the few instances where we actually are getting scientific data to help drive our decisions. If we regulate firearms, can we do it in a way that actually decreases death? And this suggests that, in fact, providing this and additional information will help drive that decision.
And again, one of these noteworthy studies, I think, that's emerging given the prohibition against research on firearms that's been persistent for so long.
Absolutely. You know, based upon the information provided by this, the authors estimate that if you replace the medium and large caliber guns with small caliber guns, it would reduce gun homicides by almost 40%. So kudos to these authors who have studied firearms in a very rigorous manner.
I join you in that. Speaking of public health issues then, let's turn to the Public Library of Science Biology. They took a look at using continuous glucose monitoring to determine at least three, and this is based on a small data set, groups of folks with diabetes and pre-diabetes that's really based on a much more long-term analysis of their glycemic responses. And they call these three groups glucotypes, and they're actually available on the web at Stanford's website for people who are interested in that. So just a very brief review of the problem. What about pre-diabetes? It turns out that without intervention, they say 37 to 70% will develop diabetes within 4 years. From one population study and another, a Chinese population, 58% by 4 years and 45% at 20 years. So what they did was they took this continuous glucose monitor and only 57 subjects, so not too many, but subjects who ranged in age. And also, they did not have a previous diagnosis of diabetes, but some of these folks it looked like could have had pre-diabetes. They took a look for 2 weeks at their glucose levels in their blood using this continuous glucose monitor. And then they fed them 3 standardized meals in the morning. One of the meals was cornflakes and milk. The other was a peanut butter sandwich. And the third was a ProBar protein bar. Each of the participants received this specific meal twice. And then they took a look at, well, all right, what happens to your blood glucose? And what they found was this huge variability. Some people had this enormous high glucose spike that sustained. Some of them kind of had a medium-sized one, and others didn't really seem to have a sustained one. Although, interestingly, the cornflakes and milk resulted in a higher glycemic response in everybody, leading the authors to suggest that maybe cornflakes and milk are a bad idea for 80% of the population worldwide. But for me, the upshot of this whole thing is they were able to put people into 3 different categories. It looks like this continuous glucose monitoring is a really great way to stratify people, not only the presence of diabetes that may be occult, but for pre-diabetes, and that is a place where intervention is possible.
Elizabeth, I'm glad you chose this particular study because we currently diagnose diabetes either on the basis of a single hemoglobin A1C or glucose measurement or doing a glucose tolerance test, doing a continuous glucose monitoring. By the way, it was done with what's called a Dexcom G4 glucose continuous monitoring device, which provides glucose measurements every 5 minutes. There's a great heterogeneity. So this can identify not only pre-diabetes, but also can assess in people that have prediabetes or diabetes, how do they respond to certain meals and how can we change their diet based upon that? So this is really novel. I look forward to the future studies to say, can we use this information to drive better outcomes in patients that have diabetes or prediabetes?
Finally, let's turn to your last one. That's a really novel thing, a treatment for dilated cardiomyopathy in Annals of Internal Medicine.
This is a case report, but because of its novelty, you selected it. So it started with a 57-year-old gentleman that had a 2-year history of what's known as a dilated cardiomyopathy. The heart muscle is affected so that it doesn't contract normally, and as a result, the heart enlarged and the pumping function of the heart significantly declined. They did a biopsy that indicated that there were actually inflammatory cells in the heart muscle. And based upon that, he received subcutaneous injections of an anti-inflammatory agent, an interleukin-1 inhibitor, anakinra. And within 2 to 4 weeks, he had a substantial improvement in his symptoms, and his heart function improved significantly. This is really an unprecedented clinical improvement with the use of anakinra to inhibit interleukin-1, otherwise used for rheumatoid arthritis.
I at least applaud greater specificity of the interruption of inflammation. And that's what this suggests to me, that our understanding of that is increasing so that we can quit using the shotgun approach that's represented by most steroids, and that who knows what all the implications might be for other conditions.
Elizabeth, you're right. It's identifying the right pathway and individuals who will respond to that particular medication.
Very good. On that note, of course, I'm going to talk about the diabetes subtypes this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.